Let's keep recording, yeah.
Okay, here it goes. Because then it's also for my benefit as well as the machine.
All right, so let me start, and then you guys, we'll back into the conversation. So I think the turn we got to was, there's kind of a part one and part two. There's a theoretical kind of, you know, substrate, and then there's the answering the so what question as it ramifies into different social domains. Economics, medicine, mindfulness, you know, religion. I mean, we've listed economic, you know, we've listed law, we've listed a lot of these. But the rock bottom theoretical substrate that I think Mike really expressed really well, even though I know jack shit about physics, but you're really great at explaining it to somebody who doesn't know.
Yeah.
Sorry. You know, physics, but you know, it's really about the Möbius strip figure. I think is great because that has a long, long history, reaching back through this entire intellectual genealogy. You know, the most popular version is Gödel, Escher, Bach, but there's a Gregory Bateson systems theory version of it, etc. But it's about locating the twist that cannot be algebraically and algorithmically expressed or represented in the contingency, in the negativity of the contingency of the real-time temporality that locates the twist in a way that's qualitatively different from the quantitative, oh, if we just add more numbers in a linear fashion and get a bigger computer, we'll be able to see the twist.
Right.
So that's part one. There's a continental philosophy version of that I can do. There's a physics version that you can do. There's a biological version you guys can do. There's a kind of cultural anthropology of biology version you can do, among other things. And then part two is, okay, so what? How does this change how, and how can we sell to people how it changes how we think about massive medical communities of people who have autoimmune disorders, for whom this approach to medicine isn't working? How does it change being able to explain the huge thing around mindfulness, meditation, people existentially, you know, feeling like the more their lives are managed by this computational regime, the less meaningful it is? You know, how does it change how we think about markets? How does it change how we think about legal judgment?
How does it change the way in which we invest trust in certain kinds of computational systems that are being built up on the promise that you don't have to give up something like a molecular biology view of the world? You just need to add enough pieces together. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So can you summarize what you were talking about in terms of global induction quickly, just to sort of search and wait?
Okay, so essentially what I said was our understanding of holism and global today seems to me to be heavily informed by the early modern paradigm of reductive materialism, and deterministic reductive materialism. We define the global as a concatenation of all the locals, or the whole is the sum of the parts. So we can analytically define the global as a sum of all the local parts. And so what modern physics tells us, what quantum mechanics tells us, is that we cannot define the global this way any longer. The mathematical argument for that would be the Koppen-Specker theorem, where you cannot embed all local measurement contexts in one big global algebra. It doesn't work. And a visual representation of that might be the Möbius strip. Another one might be the idea of taking a small local patch of Euclidean geometry, like the surface of a sphere, and locally that little patch on the surface of a sphere is indistinguishable from the same exact patch on the surface of a torus.
Right.
And so if you're on that patch, how do you know that globally you're on a sphere versus a torus? You can't know. There's no way to know, because Euclidean, in terms of the local Euclidean context, is identical. There's many other such examples. So the question is, how do we produce an algebraic description of the global that's viable in terms of a physical argument? The way you do that is to inductively create a global algebra via an overlap of equivalence classes of local algebras. And the argument is that you can create an accurate picture of the global this way. But there are two things to keep in mind. One, when you do this, you're actually changing the global. So creating an overlap this way.
This is the key point.
Which is always done in the context of a local measurement. I mean, that's the key.
I'll just say that this will be the buy-in for humanists.
Okay.
When they understand that.
Good. Because when you inductively create a global picture this way, it's always done operatively in the course of a local measurement. Okay, that's the key.
Yeah.
So, and then the other thing is when that local measurement is complete, when you've actually taken a local observable and evaluated it via measurement event, you've now changed the global once again. So,
could you give a concrete example of that? I understand the sphere and the torus, mm-hmm. and they have a little patch. Okay, so that I'm sure we all understand. So two big questions. It seems to me that a lot's at stake here. So,
yeah.
I think it's worth going slowly. For a couple of minutes, okay, and try to understand if we can make really explicit sense of Mike's claim that you cannot find it all locally, you have to have something global as well, mm-hmm. and you cannot have local information about it, yet when you find the global, it changes your local descriptor.
Right.
That's what you're saying.
Right.
Right. And I guess an example would be, is I'm on a torus or I'm on a sphere, are rather different things to know. But what does it mean to know? What does it mean to know? What does it mean to know it locally?
Mm-hmm.
So can we just take our time? Like, what's the analog, for example, in a population that's a medical population that are genetically different from one another?
Mm-hmm.
Or what's an example of the same thing that we're talking about in the political situation,
mm-hmm.
where you know we have the American political system? Just let's be concrete,
mm-hmm.
so that we're not jumping too fast, because you're making a huge claim.
Mm-hmm. So let's take an example. For me, it's best to begin with a concrete example from the physics, so that we don't make analogies that are imprecise, or we don't draw extensions that are imprecise. So for me, it's tough. I'll pick EPR, since that's something that most people are at least somewhat familiar with. Just this idea, and you can actually define it in classically sensible way. This is where you have two particles that are related because they both came from the same source, they're traveling in opposite directions, and you're gonna measure something, I'm gonna try to be as general as possible, something about particle A, and when you make that measurement about particle A, it alters the possible measurements for particle B before particle B has been measured.
Right, got it.
And it's non-local, so we can't explain this in terms of efficient causality, where there's some physical mechanism where the two things are connected because these things are too far apart. You'd have to have a superluminal propagation of energy in order to explain the correlations mechanically. Again, mechanistic materialism fails in physics way. So the global in this example would be the composite measurement, considering both of those particles together. So let's say your universe just consists of these two particles. So the global picture will be a measurement of the state of each particle, right? So the question is, if I make a local measurement, and a locally contextualized measurement of particle A, how on earth does that actualization, right, that measurement outcome, alter the possible measurements for particle B? How does this happen? In what way does this happen? It happens, at least in physics, in the way that we've been talking about. If you look at this as an event ontology, the event that becomes actual at measurement A changes the global state. The whole global state of affairs has now been altered, so that particle B, before it's measured, has a much more restrictive set of possible measurement outcomes than it did before. And
how are those determined? Probabilistically?
Yeah, probabilistically. It validates, you have to do multiple measurements. It's all verified statistically. So the question is, what's like a classical analog of this, where people can sort of make sense? Okay, I can see how that happens. The example I gave in my first book, because Armageddon had just come out, I think I mentioned this before, was like, you're on Earth and you're about to go to medical school. You're all excited. You have a future of many possibilities ahead of you. And someone says, so where are you going to be next year? It's your senior year. You say, I've been accepted to Cornell Medical School, and that's where I'm going to be. I'm pre-med. You define yourself by a future state. I am, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, great. So you, and it's true, if you were to define your probability space at that moment, you, from your perspective, it's vast, right? But this asteroid has been knocked on a collision course with the Earth. And little do you know that within 1 month, you're not going to be in medical school. You're not going to be anywhere. No one's going to be anyplace. So when did that state change? The minute that asteroid got knocked on the collision course? Because it's too far away to have any classical mechanical connection.
Right.
So when does the state change? When you become aware of the asteroid in this imminent collision, that's when the person's state changes? No. In physics, we say the local probability space has been altered instantly, as soon as that non-local event occurs. So what the global picture, which would be equivalent of the twist in the Mobius strip, would be this God's eye view where you can see, oh, I see, this event has now altered this probability distribution. Just like you could do in an EPR experiment, where the things are only 30 feet apart in the lab, or 30 meters apart. So everyone intuitively knows what a global God's eye view of a system is.
Let me be a classical physicist critic of what you said.
Yeah.
Golly gee, at the beginning of time, there was a Big Bang, and we just integrated the equations from the initial conditions of the Big Bang.
Yeah.
And 14,000 cranks later, we get the fact that that asteroid's going to veer off and hit the Earth.
Mm.
So it never was the case that you could have been at Cornell. Okay? In other words, buried in your argument is we could not have known about the asteroid. We come to know about the asteroid, and therefore that changes our probability calculation for the future.
No, but that's too Bayesian, because now you're saying it's just your knowledge of the system has changed the outcome. That's not it, because remember, these events are not pre-statable. So this is where the analogy breaks down. Yeah, an asteroid's a classical object, and you should be able to define it with Newtonian physics. No, let's leave that part of it out. Just think of it in terms of all these unprestatable events, like in an EPR experiment. That's where we need to get back to the actual physics.
Okay.
You cannot pre-state a measurement outcome on one arm of an EPR experiment.
Okay.
And therefore, you cannot define the whole global system, particle A and B, classically. You can't do it.
So basically, your basic claim is you can't repeat the classical physics.
Yeah, you can't. Uh-huh. And a weak determinism version of that, like sticking in your paper when you were defining weak versus strong determinism, would be a hidden variables interpretation of EPR, right, where it's like, well, there are these hidden degrees of freedom that if only we knew what they were, we would be able to define the emergence, at least weakly, at least some.
Yeah.
And the fact is, this cannot be done in physics. This
right.
has been tried. It's the nail is in the coffin of a deterministic description of the global in this case. So now the question is, okay, well, what is there some way I could maybe probe the global structure and gain some information about some aspect of my local measurement that I don't otherwise have access to? That was the second part of what I had said before. And because that, to me, is the exciting part of it, where you're basically making an argument to people, hey, you can gain mileage out of redefining the global this way. Like in biology, you can solve problems by not defining the global via a bunch of clinical trials, random clinical trials. You can actually improve your picture of the global by looking at it inductively, which seems antithetical to what induction means. Induction seems to be vague and hazy, and it's like, okay, it's not as good as a deductive analytical construction of the global. And we would basically be arguing that, no, it's just the opposite. This inductive picture of the global actually gives you a better and more useful picture of the global, and we can define the utility by the accuracy of local measurements, or by even the possibility of local measurements that weren't possible before.
Yeah.
And I can think of lots of different analogs in lots of different fields, but that's better for you guys.
Can I throw in something that's way less sophisticated, but is on this last point, which is I think that one of the keys to this is not just that we can come up with precise analogs or defensible analogs. This invites a shift in intellectual style, intellectual mood. I know that in anthropology, cultural anthropology, there's been some floundering about what to do about the fact that you can have something like, now I'm going to use this language, an inductive global, that you can name sort of empirically. It's really hard to do, and maybe you need lots of scholars working on a single set of problem. But once you name a kind of, if you will, an object that is an inductive global, there's lots of other stuff that becomes possible as a result of that. And so methodologically, a payoff is, this is why I made the reference to Aristotle, is there's this way in which if certain kinds of events are non-prestatable, or certain kinds of states are non-prestatable, then you go and look. Mm-hmm. And looking can be really sophisticated. But you can then determine a set of things inductively, empirically. And now you can do all sorts of other kinds of stuff because you've done that. And this is going to run both directions as well. There's those sort of micro-singularities that are going to change the singular form of this complex big thing that you're looking at, and vice versa. But this, it seems to me that this invites a certain kind of intellectual style for dealing with things like biological phenomena or the growth of the medical industry or something, that resists a certain set of temptations that are palpable as a result of the algorithmic world that's being driven by the rise of the Google culture and its surveillance infrastructures.
Yeah.
So this is why, let me try and make bridges. So this is why in my talk a couple of days ago I talked about operators. So let me try to begin to make some bridges and see what you think okay. So when I talked with Nicholas and also with you, I'm thinking about how to make this kind of picture useful to these other fields without committing the Pythagorean error, which would be to mistake the Pythagoras improper, which is correct, for this more general project. Okay, so, because I think it works, okay. So just remind people, so Petitot wrote a very interesting essay in a book that was otherwise not so useful, Naturalizing Phenomenology, right? Mm-hmm. And in the essay, he tried to think about things like qualities, like, you know, red, etc. He's kind of normally defined as predicates, and how to think about them in terms of a kind of generalized historical phenomenology, which does not depend on the classical phenomenological subject. The way he did it was to bring in those ideas from fibrobundle theory, which we're familiar to, right? And I think I always thought it was very, very productive, and that's behind some of the things that Mike is talking about. And that also goes all the way back to Deleuze's last chapter, Deleuze and Guattari's last chapter. Actually, if you read it carefully, when he talks about smooth and striated, he's not talking about just merely running geometry. To mathematicians' eyes, it seemed that he was trying to adopt ideas from fibrobundle theory. I'll skip the technical part for another day, but now. So I'm not the only one to notice this, so that's, I think that was behind Petitot's idea of how to vary, let's say, POV, neighborhoods of POVs, points of view, around and around in the multiplicity. I'm using two senses at least, and yet be able to say there's a quality called red, which is invariant across, okay, different, let's say, shifts of position, not a single person position. This is also behind the picture that Mike's drawn before of induction, this kind of patching together. There are other words we can use, abduction might be a different word we might want to employ. Second point is the values in the fiber bundle, the values in the fiber that are taken by these kinds of, in these kinds of inductively created globals, let's put it that way, such as what we used to call red. How does that work? Well, that brings up the question of measurement, which people have talked about before, the question of the problem of measure, which I think should be part of our project.
Yeah. Oh, it's hugely important.
Of course,
yeah.
Vera Blumont has written very interesting about this, which is to replace the notion of number by the notion of operator. I've been saying the same thing. So it's really great. So several people are thinking about this, which means not about adopting physics. Okay, it's up to everybody to think, now what would be the analog to what physics did in quantum mechanics? To really foregrounding, not to thinking of measure as action and operation.
No, this is right? this is a hugely important point. Yeah.
Right? That, rather than a value,
yes.
So to speak.
Yes.
Right? So that brings up the question of what is the space of operators? I mean, the mathematician's notion is the space of operators. But if you're truly non-precedible, even that has to be, you know, progressively determined as we go forward.
Absolutely.
Right? That's
really
cool.
This is music to my ears because, I mean, at the end of the day, my philosophical orientation is, you know, I'm a pragmatist. I'm a pragmatist thinker. You know, and this is what I love about Isabel Stengers' work. I've told Isabel more than once, you know, for me, you're a pragmatist philosopher. This is where interest in James comes from. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, the contingency of measurement, you know, working from inductive to deductive out, what you're really talking about, and I think what you're talking about from that point of view is, this is a qualitatively different way of thinking about what knowledge is and how you get it. It's not like you got to know everything first to do anything. You start with the contingency of doing anything in a finite location, and that's how you build out to this virtual global, this virtual whole that is shaped by and shapes.
What makes
it you could say the contingency of measurement, you could say the contingency of a particular practice, a particular language game. I mean, there's different...
What I heard in this was Dewey's reconstruction of philosophy.
Yeah, yeah, it
this
is.
This is like, but we actually do know something. And so we go into a new situation, it's highly contingent, and it's not yet, we've not yet determined what's unsettled about the situation, or what the problem is even.
Yeah.
But we know something because we've done this before.
Right.
And then we make a set of determinations, and part of the intellectual work is to sort of inductively name enough about what's going on in order to make a warranted judgment, and then that commitment that allows us to do something else.
Right. And see, that's
and
the,
that recursivity.
Yes, and that's the connection for me between that and pragmatism and autopoiesis theory, because
yes.
the qualitative shift is like, look, there's a massive exponential complexity differential between the environment of any system and the system. No system can do one-to-one correspondences between all its internal states and everything in the fucking universe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's start there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's you have to understand that the problem for any measurement, for any system, and this happens in the contingency of real time, is actually reducing complexity.
Mm-hmm.
That's problem one. So not only you don't, in fact, you don't want to know everything.
Yeah.
the fantasy of knowing everything
is
exactly backwards.
It's exactly right.
You
this
know?
Is, I mean, this is maybe this is a...
The world will tell you.
When you know...
The complexity of the environment will tell you. And not for epistemological reasons.
Yeah.
This is not an epistemological problem, in my view.
Yeah.
And to frame it as an epistemological problem is... Just to take you down all kinds of cul-de-sacs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, before right. what you're saying, then probability is a problem. If we frame things in terms of, you asked, is it probabilistic? And I said yes. For me, that's a problem.
Well, in the physics, it's a problem. It's in the physics. Only in that physical.
Well, I want to go back to Stu's question about giving an example.
Yeah.
And this is an example of how we proceed. The example provided by Mike makes sense to a lot of us here, okay? But here's another example, but that might be rather specialized. So here's another example from someone, which is, okay, that's also from the talk I gave a couple of days ago. It is also technical, but it can be described in hopefully more everyday language, which is acoustics, in terms of the acoustics of a thing, like a plate, and you bang at it, you hear some sound kind of ringing off the plate. You cut a drill hole in the plate, you bang at it, it sounds different. Okay? No matter where you bang at it. So in a sense, you think banging on a plate is a local thing. Here's a point, I have a little point, I excite that plate at this point. And how it vibrates, well, yes, it depends on the materials and all kind of thing, but it's just a point thing, you know? If you excite at a point.
Right.
And yet, it's amazing, is that the geometry or the topology, the holes that are in the space far away, it can be so far away, there's no way for a signal to really get there and come back again. Actually, structure, condition, the local. It's amazing. That is, the global topology of the space actually changes the local and the dynamic.
I'm so glad you gave an example of it, because I was trying to think it. Can I say what I think you just said? Well, I could say it slightly mathematically. The eigenfunctions of the plate depend upon the boundary conditions. The holes in the fucking plate, which are 17 feet away, okay, in this big gong, if you drill a hole way over there, it alters the eigenfunctions.
Yes.
The eigenfunction is something that is definable over the entire gong.
Mm-hmm.
It's not definable locally, it's a Laplacian, okay? Therefore, if there's a hole way over there, it changes the way the bell rings.
That's exactly it.
Right?
Okay.
So I was trying to think of an example that gives where the hole bears, in a funny sense, non-locally on the behavior of the part we hit it, and that does.
That's it.
Right?
That's it. That's the example.
But so, can you sort of rehearse, so why does this problematize probability?
Oh, no, it doesn't address that. I'm talking about global. This is a way to think about global.
But just to stick with it, because look, why don't we try to get to a social example or something like that from what you said? Because the magic mathematically of the move that you just made, see if I've got it right, is the eigenfunction is defined by the Laplacian, and it's over the entire bell, okay? That's why when you change the eigenfunction by drilling a hole 14 feet away, on this giant gong, you change the modes and therefore the tone that you get out
to
of
be,
it.
To try
but there's something that is over the whole. It's the eigenfunction, okay? Due to the fact that it's a linear analysis of the Laplacian, right?
Yep.
That's where it comes out.
Yep.
Okay, and the linear analysis gives you something that's instantaneous,
yep.
da 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 da.
Yep.
Okay, is there an example that we can think of a social system? They must be all over the place. One example will move us forward a lot. So a social system where something changed and it changed everything. For example, Trump got elected and it fucking changed everything. Okay, is that an example?
Art. So a painter told me, but you shall come.
No, no. Problem.
So a painter, one of my famous students who was a painter before he came to work with my lab, Eric Conrad said, as a painter, you face a white canvas, you put a red dab of ink, paint on the canvas, you ask, what is this value? And all this is a value as a painter, to the painter. And then take a dab of green paint, you put it anywhere you want on the white canvas. Not only does it change as you, its value, it assumes the value as you put the dab on, but it also changes the value of the red, no matter where you put it. Right? This is a beautiful example. It's
can,
a beautiful,
can I add to that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my first wife, Lizzie, died 4.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I found myself thinking, I watched this paint. And you guys have been to our house. I mean, mm-hmm. they're painting. We're all over the place. So, you know, Lizzie was a good artist. And I watched her do the following. And it's your two dabs. Mm-hmm. Okay? And she was going to make a painting that was going to be of some mountain wooded scene. So she comes up to her canvas, and she makes a wiggly brown line. Well, obviously, this is going to be a tree trunk. You and I can tell, okay? Once it's there, what dawns on me watching what she does is that is, and I think this may be a crux word for us, it's an enabling constraint. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's like a line in improvisational comedy. Where each line is an enabling constraint for the next line. Right. So this paints this brown thing. And once she's done that, she can put a glint of white on one side, and that's where the sun's shining on. Yeah. What she is, as this happens, she is enabling the painting that she's making by the very constraints that she puts into it.
Totally, no, totally.
And that whole thing then becomes, finally, the painting's done. She says, oh, then I'll put a leaf here, then I'll...
Yeah, well, this is what Nicholas Luhmann says about, I mean, this is his theory of art, and art is a social system, but also poetry and social theory. You know, he says, look, let's take a poem. The poem doesn't...
A poem.
The poem doesn't exist in the world. How poems start? They start with a single mark that distinguishes a field from a ground, or object from a field. And that mark is absolutely contingent. It could be radically otherwise. But with that mark establishes the constraint, to use your language, by which, through recursive closure, the red speaks to the green speaks to the red, the purple speaks to both of them.
And you end up with a poem.
Well, you end up, here's the crazy thing, you start off with the absolute contingency of the mark, because the poem has to distinguish itself from everything else in the world. Mm-hmm. It's what Michel Serre calls a quasi-object, right? So it has to distinguish itself from everything else in the world. So it starts with an absolutely contingent mark, but through recursive closure, by the time the poem is done, it has a sense of absolute necessity in Aristotelian
terms. It becomes itself.
It becomes itself. And not because the becoming itself was preloaded and you knew everything first and you could build the poem to represent it. I think non-representational is a key part of this conversation too, philosophically. Yeah. You know, but it builds up in real time. This is, again, where temporality is important. Through recursivity, its own internal necessity, to use Aristotle's terms. Let me just finish this off. Yeah. So to stay with Shen Wei's example. With the first dab of red in the poem, red could be a zillion different things. But by the end of the poem, through recursivity and by introducing recursive constraints, you have in the poem or in any other artwork, you've literally painted yourself into a corner because of recursivity, and that's where the internal necessity comes from.
Yes.
And so you can't say just anything about, the bird in the poem, because at that point, you've recursively introduced a bunch of constraints around that image.
So, Stuart, you could imagine, I would imagine through this very easily, we could start through your idea of enabling constraint and then sort of clarification. We could build this up pretty quickly to a political system. And start thinking about this.
Just to come back on the closure.
Yeah.
At some point, this painting is finished. Why is it finished? Why doesn't she just keep dabbing forever? Well, at some point, she looks at it and she's enabled and constrained and enabled and constrained until finally It is what it is.
And any practicing artist or poet will tell, because I started off as a poet, and they will tell you, and if you keep tinkering with it, you're going to fuck it up.
Gerhard Richter has asked, what's the secret to your success? Knowing when to stop.
Yeah.
Same thing with software engineering.
Gary, I've got the opening line for a poem. Mm-hmm. Ready? I love this, okay? I don't know what to do with it, but it came to me 2 days ago. This is the way poems start. We both write poems. A singular elf. I don't know what it's going to become, but it's got to become something. It's such a neat image. What's a singular elf?
We should let that elf decide.
You've already eliminated a lot of stuff.
Can I name a couple things that are floating around? I don't know quite how to map them systematically, but just so one of the things about this example that Carrie was just riffing on is it goes back to this question of how can you get the coherence of an inductive global, just to use that language again, from the beginning. How do you produce, what's its origin? I mean, how can you create these sort of complex closures that are interdependent, beginning with some sort of singular thing that can ultimately end up as something that's sort of complex and self-identified? So you could tell a similar story about the cell, which would be a quite interesting kind of story about that. So I think that's important. Second thing that I think is important is the way in which these inductive globals are overlapping and nested. A set of elements within an inductive global itself may be an inductive global analytically cut in a different kind of way, and may in fact be an element in a different inductive global, which is really important in the interactive levels in living systems in which a certain set of elements that form part of one system, one dynamical system, and it can be part of another dynamical system. So I would just, let me give an example of that from cultural anthropology. There's this super quick and dirty mid-19th century, the things that will become cultural anthropology are sitting in Oxford or Cambridge, and the colonialists have brought artifacts in from all over the world, and you've now got these huge piles of artifacts from these cultures from all over the world, and you think, okay, the problem here is human nature. I've got all this diversity, and I'm going to try and name a thing called human nature, and it's going to be predicated more or less on the English gentleman. You know, why would the English gentleman be? Why should we take animism seriously? Because I can imagine a scenario in where I, as a 19th century scientist, would be trying to explain how the world works, and animism would be a theory about how the world works. There now, the native is not so primitive. The native is just doing what we're doing, just not doing it very well. Okay, but the problem is human nature, and that's the kind of object that you're dealing with. By the time you get to the end of the 19th century with somebody like Emile Durkheim, you're like, no, these are complex systems. They have an integrity to them such that any element within the system is defined by the integrity of the system and not just the other way around. Right. And I'm going to name that the social. Mm-hmm. But the social is indexed to a set of needs that we know in advance. Okay, so now I can provide an explanation of animism as a social phenomenon in which any weird little individual thing somebody's doing seems so silly and arbitrary, but it's important because this is a manifestation of the social and it reproduces a certain kind of coherence, and that coherence allows for psychological health, it allows for language to function, it allows for people to avoid incest, but I know what the kind of human needs are in advance. Okay, so now I can do all this comparable work among and between social systems, but I'm buying into integral wholes that are different than me, the English gentleman, sitting in my office. So I'm sort of partway there. The next step in cultural anthropology is, well, we don't even know in advance. We've got the ghost of human nature floating around in advance, giving you your list of the needs for which the social is a function, and we're not yet to the point where we're treating the social as something with integrity. So then the cultural anthropologist says, okay, now I gotta do participant observation, and if I want to know what the Dinka believe about witchcraft, I've got to like go live with the Dinka, get far enough inside their world that I can explain how the world functions on its own terms without a reference to this other a priori. Mm-hmm. The difficulty at that point in cultural anthropology in the 1960s or whatever is we now have integral wholes, inductive globals, but they're non-comparable.
Yeah.
And so you get the idea of the ethnographic present. That is to say, I'm treating this cultural system out of time and space as though I can name it as this self-enclosed system that never changes, and I can name the logic of it, but now I can't relate it to anything else.
Right.
And part of the challenge the last 50 years in cultural anthropology has been to maintain what was one, W-O-N, one intellectually, about this sort of integral nature of these cultural formations, mm-hmm. right. but to nest them within yeah. something that makes them comparable. That is to say, we see how they change over time, they're connected to other things. And
all right, I have one thing to say about this. Then the problem becomes how to make that desire, not to make the false move to think that solving that problem is a representational enterprise.
This is what I've been trying to talk
about. But it's a practical enterprise.
This is the shift. I mean, I'll stop talking on this point, but the shift that is not yet fully articulated in cultural anthropology has been to say participant observation isn't just a methodological limitation on the representation of another.
Yeah.
It's the naming of a different sort of situation that I'm trying to bring to articulation. Namely, that the story I'm telling is not the story of the Dinka, it's the story of me among the Dinka.
Yeah.
So to switch this to the... Let's see,
well, actually, I'd like to say something. I've been trying to say something for about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. And actually, I think this conversation is really good, but we should be thinking about it pragmatically. I think now, first of all, we're not going to have a killer definition, because there is no singular definition. We just decided that. Yeah. But we can have a provisionary introduction. We can have a first volume of definitions, which is each of us working through all of our definitions, like what we've been doing. But then we have a final section, which is what you just brought up, which is our where we come together and contribute about overlaps and reflections at the very end. Right. So then we have a structure for our volume.
That's a really nice idea.
Say more. You had 20 minutes, come on.
I've been waiting for 20 minutes. Sorry.
Is what we're doing ultimately, it seems to me that what we're doing is defining ontology, redefining ontology, as praxeology.
Well, there is a praxeology to it, I think.
We're saying that it is, because like Shinwei was saying, Vera and her notion of replacing the role of numbers with the notion of functions, or of operators. Isn't this what we're saying? We're saying if you want to know what is, you have to... And by the way, praxeology, not in the sense of human action.
Yeah.
There's this... Because I was thinking of praxeology as, von Mies and really, it was initially... the term was coined by this French philosopher of science, Louis Bordeaux, who defined it more broadly as just the science of function, where when you define what is as a process, that's crucial. Because then it built into that idea is the idea that whenever you talk about global, implicitly, you're talking about a process. You're talking about a structure that's in a constant state of unfolding, as opposed to a static block totality. Most people, when they hear the word global or holistic, they think, oh, the totality of what is. Carrie, you mentioned Gerda Schabach, and so Hofstadter brings up the Epimenides paradox. That's another example of thinking that might represent what we're saying. How do you solve the notion of the global as an inductive produced process? Another nice thing about it is it solves paradoxes like the Epimenides paradox. Because how do you solve the Epimenides paradox? Cretans, all liars, right? That's the fun thing about it. The solution is to redefine all. You redefine the totality, the global, in the word all, as something that's in a state of process. There's no longer a paradox, but it all depends on this particular Cretan, whether he or she is telling a lie at that moment or not.
Oh, that's absolutely right.
There's no paradox anymore because we've redefined the global.
If I could actually add a little bit to that, there's... So I would actually even frame it as a haunting of a praxeology. Because what we're talking about is not just how practice makes an ontology, but we're also talking about how practice makes a specific ontology. Right? And to become aware of the other types of ontologies that are also there.
Practice is a specific ontology. I mean, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. Yeah. Is that one of the things I found quite loving about your paper, it's in part what I was thinking about this paper recirculated is a reminder again that the reality itself is capable of experience. That is to say that ontologies have an existential dimension to them.
Right.
That in order for potentially to become an actuality, something has happened.
Right.
And maybe this is from the point of view of the cultural anthropologist, but there's a way in which I want the space-time to be an existential category or something like that. But I want to be able to talk about it in ontological terms.
Right.
Whitehead is clearly haunting us right now. Whitehead, the thing is, some of us have read my head, and I don't propose that we adopt this vocabulary because it is very special, but I really do think it could be interesting to maybe explicitly bring some of that in for our own information and see what's useful about that.
I do think so.
I mean, why I'm excited about this conversation is I hear these echoes. I think one of the first times I talked to this dude was to say, well, you know, start thinking about my head on your own. So it's interesting, and the same thing with Christopher Alexander, the last of his four books, he said he revealed that he was studying wine early on, he never said it before. And he said, in the case of architecture of Christopher Alexander, who's been mistakenly associated with Brutalism, he said that those patterns we're talking about mid-career, the 15 basic patterns, they're not to be taken as schema at all. They should have been thought of as operations, things to do, not patterns, but things to do.
Is there something that is close to the surface, let me see if that I'm just feeling pointed at around the room. I was really struck with your description of cultural anthropology, which I know is spot that I urge you, that ends by saying all of humanity is co-evolving with one another. It's not that there is a human nature that's fixed. There is something that's co-evolving across the globe as we intermesh with one another and become with one another. ISIS whoever else you want. So there's this evolving becoming. Is echoed in what you said, Michael, okay? Is it echoed in the notion of pragmatism, which is a praxis? Praxis is a process in time. Okay, it's not that there needs to be, that was your Greek liar thing, puts time back into it in a way that redefines all. Is hiding in Whitehead, which is a process ontology, it's not a thing ontology.
Right.
Is that what's not far away from what we're talking about? Classical physics is time comes in as a parameter, but it's not a becoming.
Right.
It's an entailed elaboration of the initial conditions.
Yeah. Where you talk about time versus temporality,
the real world is a largely unentailed becoming, which is sort of what Whitehead's saying.
But it's a seriality without temporality. Temporality is an emergent feature of that seriality. So you have to think of sequence without time. As a logical type of sequence. I just want to say, because I don't want to bring time back into it as some sort of built-in, intrinsic structure by which everything is measured, because that I don't think is right.
Well, the interesting thing about Whitehead is often missed, and I'll just add this to this, because you're sort of talking about this sort of unentailed becoming of the universe, or at least our cosmic epoch. What's often missed about Whitehead is his pragmatism. Is how Whitehead is deeply pragmatic and certain. And the way in which when he builds his system, and depending on what you're reading of Whitehead, I mean, it's not always evident in Process and Reality, but in certain other books for sure. But when he is generating his universe, it itself is propositional. It's a kind of proposition, it's a speculative proposition that must be verified in particular kinds of ways. And that proposition, which a lot of people forget, and this is a sort of very dogmatic reading of Whitehead, that process of speculative philosophy is local. It's a situated practice. Yeah, yeah. It's a local practice. Yeah, yeah. It itself must evolve, right? Yeah, so, prehensions, his very understanding of prehension, his understanding of, this very strange sort of abstract universe that he creates, itself needs to evolve. So those concepts might not actually be useful for us anymore, but the Whiteheadian spirit is.
Mm-hmm. And we should be able to name why they're not.
Yeah.
Well, in this manner. And I think the second, to me, hugely important point, and this is why I like Luhmann's work so much, is to say that process is always non-transparent to itself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And always proceeds because of its contingency, always proceeds blindly. Mm-hmm. So the idea of you got to know everything before you can do something is completely ass backward.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are different logical ways of making the case for why it is of necessity blind. But that's not what prevents practice. That's what enables practice.
So what I'm thinking here is also...
And that's why it's a non-representational enterprise. So you've changed the...
What do you mean when you say non-representational? What I hear is
It's you not, don't say it, you do it.
Yeah, yeah, well, right. The issues are not, the better my representation of an antecedent state of affairs is, the better my practice can be. That's not the issue.
Yeah.
The issue is the functional and operational effectiveness in this process that you were describing in Whiteheadian
you
terms.
You can't plan your research ahead of time. You
yeah, and this is this is what complexity theory in your work, you can't say we're going to build it because we know what the world looks like.
This is how we're going
to
do it.
You create the conditions out of which, because you are blind.
So let me give an specific
example. Here's how far, just for the hell of it, do you guys realize how far we are past standard complexity theory? Let me tell you what standard complexity theory is. It's not linear dynamical systems. It's attractors.
Yeah.
It's bifurcations, it's phase transitions, it's phase diagrams, and it's agent-based modeling, which is algorithmic. Nothing we're saying is either of those.
Right.
I think this is exactly right.
Yeah, we're right.
Yeah.
Can I just give an example of where non-representational is still can be like warrantable and empirical? So Anna Singh's beautiful little book, Mushroom at the End of the World, this is part of a consortium of researchers who wanted to study the relationship between two things which at first glance are non-obvious. One is, I don't remember the name of the mushroom, it's this Japanese mushroom which at certain times of the year is the most expensive biological product on the planet per gram. It's the study of the evolving price schemes and markets around this mushroom in relationship to the way in which this mushroom flourishes in places of deforestation. And so they had a number of anthropologists that went and did ethnographies in places of deforestation, which are these really interesting landscapes that are simultaneously devastating because there's a certain beauty that's lost, but they're fecund and certain things are happening in them that would never happened if these devastations hadn't taken place. And she brings this into articulation with mobile groups of immigrants who are traveling all over the world in order to find these places of deforestation because they know that these mushrooms are likely to grow there, and they ship them back to Japan to make a ton of money. Okay, so this there's like seven anthropologists working on this stuff, and they tell this story of the interactions among these variables that as they tell the story gives form to a coherent assemblage that has a logic and a function to it that doesn't quote-unquote really exist outside their narrative. Except now that they point to it, it does.
Yeah.
So it's non-representational in the sense that they didn't think that there's an object sitting out there that they have to go see and come back
that's
and depict.
Nice story.
Yeah.
And I think that for us, the way we need to keep our eye on the ball that in terms of articulating this to the outside world, that the question is going to be, well, okay, so what? And the answer is going to be, because it fucking works better.
Yeah.
No,
That's the answer to the so what.
Yeah.
Whether you're talking about medicine, whether you're talking about understanding markets, whether you're talking about understanding subcultures, it works better.
Stu's
better knowledge.
Stu's riff on the critical limitations of a certain style of personalized medicine is an answer to the question of why I should not spend $75,000 to allow Longevity Incorporated to do a workup on me.
Yeah.
Right. And we all have these examples.
Just a bit of, and what the fuck are they going to do after they've done it? They don't know what to do.
They have no idea.
What we need is a system such that, given enough people like you, close enough to you in this space, the
we
work
can try
has
a few
been
things.
Done and can continue to be done, so we'll have a good idea what to do.
Well, and here, they don't know because the fact is, and this is like taking a big dump in their lap, they don't know because they can't know.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the point. I mean, this is what Foucault says about homo economicus, as you know, the sovereign in relation to homo economicus. You don't know because you can't know.
You can't know. That's exactly right. So why do they keep getting partners and why do they keep getting investors? And because on some level, the story they tell is the story Americans want to hear, which
that's
is
right.
You are utterly unique. You are so special.
Well, it feeds into a different kind.
And the specialness that you know in your heart is true about you has a biological correlate. And if we could only unlock that biological correlate, we could fix your body or your mind in ways that you can't under regimes of quote unquote.
Right, can we switch to the world facing part of this project then for a moment? Because this thing, you don't know because you can't know. You know, those people are smart and they know that. Right. So the question is political, right? They don't want to publicly admit that.
Right.
So then why would they fund a project like ours or support a project like ours, right? I mean, for one thing, if we're small and important, it doesn't matter, okay? But if we're not going to be small, if we have to do want real support in some way, substantial support, whatever that means, okay, then they're going to say, well, why should those kinds of people want to support a project like ours? Let's put that aside, okay? We don't have to answer that right now. Now, two more examples of practical world-facing and practicality. One, going to medicine, Longo, Giuseppe Longo's in spirit with us, right, is working with Tufts, people at Tufts, and they have a field-based theory of personal,
carcinogenesis,
right? Which is worth looking at as part of the story. But another one is identity politics, right? The thing that I think about that could be useful is I have this beef about intersectionality. And I think we need to have more, you know, part of the, more people as part of the conversation to talk about that. Like Elizabeth Broach. I mentioned this with Broach, we were talking about this with her.
Right.
5 years ago, 7 years ago, she was talking at SPEP, and she said, look, I would like to talk about a very archaic philosophical concern, that is matter. Because I think the categories that we've been writing about, you know, race, gender, and stuff, they're not adequate, because precisely because they become fossilized, and you can speak so much more to this kind of question. So that's why I think these kinds of abductive or inductive approaches could be quite useful, right? In a very practical sense, a lot of these politics today that we really need, you know, post-Occupy and post-1990s politics, and some of these questions about care that I've talked about in passing in the past, do look at these questions of texturality, which in turn are actually maybe applications of these kinds of field-based approaches that Mike is talking about.
And I think this is what you see in the massive communities and user groups, you know, around autoimmune disorders. What you see is texture, and what you see is, you know, just because I checked these four identity and you know, gender boxes, I'm still sick, you know, and I'm in conversation with people who partially overlap.
And in this country, you blame the patient, or you blame the cell.
Right.
Right. This cell's a bad cell.
Yeah,
you know,
that's exactly right.
Right.
Same logic. It ignores regional and global effects.
Yeah, and experiential.
This is why I also like the idea of Kerry saying that there's the second volume, right, which is going to give multiple applications. So it can be healthcare at that particular point. I mean, this is maybe where we start thinking about who we want to invite in.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of why I raised this at the very beginning. I mean, I think that really conditions not just the abstract intellectual profiles of people to bring in, but people who in this outward-facing part of the job, you know, may just have skills and abilities that, like, I don't have.
That's right.
You know, and who understand what we're talking about or are invested in it, but can do different things with it.
That's right.
What I can do.
Because there's not, just like there's no killer definition, there's not going to be a killer app.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what we have to do is we have to have killer connections.
Yeah, I mean, and I do think with a second volume in that sense, it's a different kind of writing practice, too.
Yeah,
I was just thinking about what
it's
that
a pitch.
Like
it's pitched at a different rhetorical level. It's a different audience in terms of accessibility, how technical it is or isn't. And that may be a reason to...
Well, I think, you know...
And this is where you started off, I know, talking about kind of the two-volume...
Yeah,
two,
I mean, that, potentially. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, and I think that's... There should be...
These are good. I could eat like 100 of these.
This is one of the things I just want to...
Can I interrupt for a second? It's really important.
Yes.
Are you really important? You know what a soda cracker is?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yeah.
But not sweet.
Yeah. You're talking about like a saltine cracker?
Saltine. Uh-huh. Okay, you guys, this you can make money on this. How many saltines, without drinking any water, how many saltines do you think you can eat and swallow in a minute?
That's dry.
In a minute?
Mm-hmm. Okay. A whole minute.
I would say about 60.
Okay, 60. Okay, I'll bet you $1 million that you can't.
Okay, why?
Okay. Well, so what do you... But
well, I would eat them like five at a time.
I
could eat about 10.
You say 10? What do you think?
More like 10.
10. Okay, what do you think?
I'm going to say 5.
Okay, so 5. What do you think, Mike?
However many is in a sleeve, because I'm pretty sure I've done that many times.
that's about 20.
I guess leaving crime on the floor.
What?
I would say 10. 10 is the number that came to mind.
So in one minute? You could eat way more than 10 in one minute.
So the fun thing is, I will bet all of you, except Philip, I will bet all of you $10,000 each. That. It's hysterical. So I will tell.
We're going to test this out later. Yeah, so.
Years ago, the Santa Fe Institute, I bet this guy wrote it. I don't know how I ever learned this, but this is a deeply important thing. The answer is about 5. And the reason is, as you chew it, it becomes small and granular. It absorbs all the moisture out of your mouth. And so you get about 5 down, maybe 6 if you're really lucky. So I bet this guy, he bet me 20, and I says, I'll bet you 10,000. He had a lot of money. I says, I'll bet you 10,000 bucks. Finally, when he got to 8, down to 8, I agreed to let him do it, because I knew that he didn't have a chance on it. And so we bet 50 bucks each. So we go to the Santa Fe Institute, we put 50 bucks down on the table, and David's got the 8 crackers there, and one of the guys with us invents the saltine spatter test, you know, when you spat, but it was so precious, because he started eating and he looked at me with his, you know, complete contempt and amusement on his face, and said, I've got this nailed. Okay, and you know, he got to about 4 and he realized what he was into.
But Stu, you didn't say that we couldn't have water.
Well, yeah, he did.
You did. Oh, okay. Then I couldn't do 6.
Disabling constraint.
I'm not looking to be on water. Anyway, it's really funny, and you can make money. Just go try it sometime.
Okay. Stu, we're going to
do it later.
Stu, what if you're a drooler, though? Like me? Have you seen my pillow in the morning? Yeah. It's basically...
So wait, into the story.
So he lost, and with very, very good cheer, he gave me 50 bucks. I could have had a couple thousand from him. Yeah. He had a lot of money.
So this is Sue's idea. We should go out and hustle.
That's because you said you eat the whole box of the pizza.
It is getting past noon, and I wanted to start thinking about sort of the structure, because we spent a good hour and a half talking about this, and there's a lot of enthusiasm, and I think actually the conversation has shifted somewhat from what it was last time, which is actually really exciting.
Yeah, I think we know what we're doing now.
And
will you characterize your sense of the shift? Can you encapsulate that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the most broad possible sense, we were talking about something having to do with the motor behind something like ontogenesis. We were thinking through how it is there. I mean, we were very much concerned with this idea, at least I think this is what we were talking about, something like the unprestatable, and we were thinking about it through something vaguely looks like ontogenesis, sort of tracing and mapping this through various projects. I think
you mean in a more Simondonian.
Yeah. Possibly. You know, I mean, not all of us were talking about Simondon, but I think that there was some sort of vague. There was overlap there.
Right.
I think we've moved into this really exciting space where we've actually been able to identify how it is we move from local measurements to global impact, and how this is actually changing and has wide application, right? And that we're moving. So it's highly theoretical. It resonates with physics. It resonates deeply with theoretical biology.
With law, your description last night, your two-sentence description of the paper you did on law, is exactly what Derrida says about the difference between law and justice.
Exactly. And so,
there's a whole history of writing on this in deconstructive and continental philosophy, but also in legal systems theory, people like Gunther Teutner. I mean, law is a great place to see the relationship between the global and the local.
Right.
And the iterability of the relationship between law and justice in every, you know, instance of legal judgment.
So obviously you know a lot more about it than I do. It seems so rich.
Yeah, totally.
No, but and there's a way, actually, when we're thinking about law, I mean, this is, it could be the new critical legal theory, but very different, right? We're doing a very different kind of thing here. But, so there are all these different resonances, and I'm thinking about, like, I mean, when you were talking, and then we finally were, and then Shin Wei said something about Whitehead. I mean, Whitehead is definitely haunting this, but it's a very different sort of reading of Whitehead. But in any case, and I think, you know, personalized medicine, legal theory, all this sort of stuff has all of these sort of resonances, and it just works better on some level, right? So I think that's super productive. I think we need to really think about what we want to do and make use of this time, because we don't have that much time. Do we want to give individual presentations? Is that something we want to do? Do we want to continue this conversation? But we also should have a conversation about funding. Like, what do we want to do in terms of funding? What do we want to do about the volumes? Do we really want to put together a volume? How are we going to invite people? What's the next event? I mean, Xinwei and I have been talking about doing the spring event, where we actually bring people in, and then we start seeing how the bigger conversation happens, and who works with that. You know, do we want to start an institute? Can we start talking about, you're talking about inviting in like PhD students, postdocs, that kind of thing?
Well, Adam and I were talking, and he said that he and Xinwei had talked about, I think, which is a great idea, of in the spring maybe doing something where we kind of agree on a list of prospects, basically. Mm-hmm. And have a kind of a symposium where sort of they don't actually necessarily know that they're being screened, but we get a sense of how they interact with us, their commitments to this, what the chemistry in the group would be. And I think that's really a nice, as you kind of loosely coupled, way of handling this. But I was talking to David Wills, who was at my house last week doing a project on the Rothko Chapel, and he's in the Derrida Seminar Translations Project, and he said, we kind of did that with new kind of ABDs or recent PhDs that we've had, because they got to carry on this project for another 30 years. They got to get some, he's like, I'm not going to be translating this stuff for 30 years. And he said it achieved a kind of a similar function, and in a way it was nice to have a kind of a generational difference, between younger scholars and older scholars, kind of, thinking of the project really as a sustaining a kind of genealogy of thought that's not just about us, us people, but something larger, So that's, I'm not suggesting we do that, I'm just saying,
So the only reason I'm saying this is because, we obviously have, there's a lot of energy here and so forth, and there's, kind of a magical connection in many ways. And let's use this time wisely, I mean, because we could, look, I could do this for 4 days, just sit here talking these things out. But if we really want to do something, we should say, okay, look, we're going to do lunch, and then we'll do 2 hours, we're going to talk about this.
Yeah.
And let's make up a list of things, action items, et cetera, move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Which, just to say the obvious, is a promissory note to ourselves that we get to do this to the extent to which we can formalize it and give it some structure that allows it to have some continuity over time.
So, this...
My guess is that we all actually have something that we could say.
Yeah.
And there's seven of us. 7 times 15 minutes sounds like, what is that? 4 times 15 minutes is an hour, 7 times 15 minutes is an hour and 3/4. Right? Would we like to all say something for about 15 minutes each? After lunch? And then see what that sparks?
Well, I thought that's what we were just doing, sort of. I mean, do you have something else in mind?
I'm in the middle of doing some research that I'd kind of like to tell you guys about.
Oh, okay.
It splays over into the evolution of the law in a way that I don't understand, but I know. I begin to know why I'm excited about it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Of course,
yeah.
I don't know the literature that you know, but roughly, it's a distinction between synchronic and diachronic. Everything's about a becoming, not a being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the law becomes, and it's fascinating. So does the global economy, a lot of other things. That's part of our theme, and it's part of what it is. So I'd
love to hear about that.
Yeah, and I think it's easier to see, for lay people, it's easier to see it in the domain of law.
Right.
And legal practice than it is anywhere else.
Limited.
Yeah.
So law creates the world in which it then becomes.
Yeah.
Right?
That's exactly right.
Mm. Right, which changes each individual iteration of legal judgment.
Right.
Because of that global change.
And sort of what's wonderful about it is I begin to find my way into it, which I have for a little while, is you can't argue that it's real and important, because it is real and important, because it frames our life. So it strikes me as really powerful.
Right.
So one of the ways that possibly do this then is we it sounds like we have actually a number of projects coming up, right, that we're thinking about. But it might be nice, I tend to feel like our conversations are best anchored when we talk about them within a specific set of goals in mind. So it might be nice then to go around and think about what we might want to offer to that first or second volume.
Yeah, I think the volume thing, especially volume one, is the easy piece of the puzzle. I mean, I could say, okay, I can write this version of it within this domain of expertise. You could do the same.
Yes,
you could
do
the same. Laying out a kind of a philosophical theoretical substrate for that. I think that would be easy to do.
I think
the second part, the outward facing part, and the cultural thematizations part, you know, where the rubber meets the road, answering the so what. It's like, oh, so you guys are obsessed with this. What do you do? How does that change how we do things? I think that's the more complicated part, either in a volume and then also for just carrying forward with the group, you know. But that's good because we could go ahead and do part one while we're figuring out part two.
No, that's what I was going to suggest. Yeah. Then we structure our conversations around that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I would like, okay, so I think that's awesome. So how about after lunch? Like, Stu, you want to tell us about the...
Yeah, but awesome. why don't we all speak? We all talk for 15 minutes.
Sure. We'll talk for 15 minutes about our chapter on definitions. And then later on, we'll talk about the outreach.
But then I think we should spend at least as much effort on thinking about how to grow and how to,
We have a couple days.
What kind of day? Before, when you're leaving?
Yeah, when you're leaving.
Yeah, well, I'm going to
leave. In 20 minutes.
Tomorrow at 4. Tomorrow at 4, which means we have the morning with you, with Phil.
So I switched the morning.
Right.
So with the free, so we're going to do, instead of having free morning, we're going to have meet in the morning.
All right. So, all right, well, because some of what I want to talk about actually is both, right?
Yeah.
So it's a process.
Is both what? I'm sorry. Both of these registers.
A theoretical project and a practical project.
Yeah.
How this very process itself unfolds.
Yeah.
You know, which is what I'm trying to do. And so, for example, it includes certain kinds of, you know, I don't know, Stengerian or Grimassian principles of how one structures conversations, scatters conversations, right?
Uh-huh.
You know? So that could be quite interesting. Talking about, you know, finding people who actually are constructive rather than destructive for this sphere. So
I
think that's great.
And one thing I failed to do, which I'm sorry about, is I had kind of pseudo recruited a young PhD female PhD, Nayeli, who was really brilliant and really self taught in different domains, coming from sociology to Riemannian geometry, but not a mathematics major.
Wow.
And she's very much involved with Manfred Ludwig and Sandra Vanderbilt. Here, so she would have been natural, and because she already sees the limits of complexity science, but she's been trained in that area. Anyway, so she would have been kind of an example, someone who actually take notes and maybe reflect back to us what she's hearing, and then she would have the fearlessness to just reflect back. So I was hoping to try to do more of that. You know, we should all do more of that,
mm-hmm.
I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. People.
Is she coming? Is she coming, or
well, she was supposed to come, but she's not here now because I think she's just too busy with her dissertation.
Oh yeah.
That makes sense.
But okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking. I mean, so if you want to do 15 minutes, that's fantastic. I mean,
can I ask you? Could you mentioned structuring the book so that it reflects the fundamental thesis in terms of local and global?
Exactly.
What about doing that in a radical way, you know, the edited volume,
blah, blah, blah.
Do it in some, like, you know, there are multi-authored volumes, co-authored volumes.
Just what the world needs.
What if we, I don't even know if it's possible,
but
what if we structured the book, not as an edited volume, as a co-authored volume that was fundamentally coherent? We could write it in such a way that everybody writes the introduction, everybody writes every everybody contributes to every chapter in some way. And somehow there's a cohesiveness to each chapter that would seem to be impossible to produce.
So an artist's form and content come together.
Well, there's a certain sense in which we have to
produce an inductive global.
Yes, exactly. Can we produce an inductive
radical
global?
That's the truth. What radical would mean for us, radical writers, we make an alternate reality game. I mean, you go to a bunch of TV or do an alternate reality game, put out a couple of hit songs, and also. Issue new digital mapper, new kinds of
what is radical about that?
There's like a different notion of radical.
But
radical is the new radical is sitting in a dusty library in the archives.
That's true. Right. Right. For 8 weeks. So this is why I write on paper.
And writing with a pen on.
You know, me, we are at the point of the conversation where we should go to lunch.
Yeah, yeah, so
thinking, sounds like lunch.
I'll ask Diego Pops. Do you like Diego Pops?
I do.
Do you want to go, is that another girlfriend hangout?
No, it's fine. Although, with apologies, I have a dissertation defense at 1 p.m. on campus.
Okay.
It's very good, and today it's very good.
You
very clean.
Better get going then.
So I'm hoping that I'll be out of there by 2 or 2:30, and then I'll just get back up here as quickly as I can.
That's funny. I just think my dissertation.
Okay, you guys just actually
bring beer when you come back.
I will.
Just grab, you know, a stick.
Beer and whiskey.
There's beer. There's beer in the refrigerator.
But we'll need more. I'm thinking
guys,
ahead.
Hey, you guys have to take something to wash down.
We're going to where?
But you don't want beer. Then you go. You get the frothing problem.
That's right.
I just wanted to put this out there to make sure you guys know. Like Wednesday night, dinner at my place.
Oh, Adam and I are cooking.
Actually, Stacy wanted to do something.
I'm listening to
it. So she's
Adam and Stacy and I are cooking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or Stacy's cooking.
Stacy's just doing the whole thing.
Stacy's cooking.
So she said, yeah. So she.
I'll make martinis for everybody. I'll make the best martinis.
So wait, where are we going with this?
Lunch. It's right around the corner.
I gotta give a lecture. I can't like this, dude.
I think this is really good. Yeah,
I'm
recording
Tuesday,
this
because
I mean, just the first hour of conversation we had.
So chapter dollars.
This is Noble is, he's one of, his work is, you know, his work is quite in sync with what you've got to be. And so, and there's a really serious chapter in here about epigenetics, which is great too.
Oh, right on. That's awesome.
One of your compadres.
I've
never met him.
Yeah.
But he's wonderful.
Yeah. I just picked that up, so.
Yeah,
it's Lexington.
Yeah.